You're listening to DTFHN for June 23rd, 2026. I'm your mass-produced artisanal host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass delusion and genuine brilliance share the same common thread. Today's a day, one the elegant are locked in a bare-knuckle boxing match, and somehow, both winning. Let's get into it. A federally licensed exchange in the United States is taking retail bets on whether the American military will assassinate a foreign head of state. And the heaviest order flow is coming from accounts sitting inside the kill chain. That sentence is real. That is a thing that exists in the world right now. And it is not the lead story this week, because the president is also running a meme coin out of the White House and flew the top 220 holders to his golf club for a private dinner. Seating chart arranged by how much they bought. The Demon Deal has a new piece called Crypto in 2026. Oh, this is the bad place. And the title is doing exactly the work it needs to do. The reference is to The Good Place, where the protagonist realizes the paradise she's living in is actually an engineered torture chamber. Deal's argument is that crypto has achieved the same trick at civilizational scale. A world so relentlessly absurd you laugh, and the laughing is how you know it's hell. But let's follow his core argument all the way, because it's sharp. Go back to Econ 101. A market is a price discovery mechanism for goods and services whose value comes from outside the market itself. Wheat prices reflect something about harvests. Stock prices reflect expectations about real cash flows. The measuring instrument points at reality. Deal's claim is that crypto instruments have severed that link entirely. The price of Bitcoin measures the price of Bitcoin. The price of a memecoin measures the collective belief that someone dumber will show up tomorrow. The price of a Trump coin measures the willingness of access seekers to pay for presidential time. None of it points at productive reality. It is a closed loop. Run this forward. If you build an entire financial ecosystem where no instrument references productive activity, what you get is not a market. It is a extraction engine. Capital goes in, it circulates among speculators, and the only output is a transfer from latecomers to early holders. Deal walks through the pipeline. A college freshman buys $10 of cum rocket, watches it move, feels the dopamine hit, and at no point does his capital touch productive enterprise. Scale that to trillions, and you have a shadow economy that produces nothing except poverty redistribution. Upward. The stablecoin angle is the one that should genuinely alarm people. Federal statute has now blessed a shadow dollar system that migrates the savings of the global poor onto the balance sheets of opaque private companies. This is the closed system problem at its most dangerous. Not open protocols anyone can audit. Private ledgers, private reserves, private control. Wearing the costume of financial inclusion. The tools to build open, transparent, auditable financial infrastructure exist. They have existed for years. The question was never capability. It was always who controls the off switch. And right now, the answer is getting worse. Valve's new hardware launches today, and this one's worth getting excited about. The strongest argument against the Steam Machine is the hardware. RDNA 3 graphics in mid-2026, 8 gigs of VRAM, a Zen 4 CPU when Zen 5 exists. The closest discrete GPU comparison is the RX 7600, a card that was merely adequate when it launched 3 years ago. Valve is advertising 4K 60 with an FSR asterisk. And that asterisk is doing a lot of heavy lifting. If you're spending console money on a box, shouldn't the silicon at least be current generation? It's a fair critique, and it completely misses the point. Pull up the Steam Machine store page. Read the fine print that nobody puts in fine print because Valve put it in the headline. This is your PC. Install your own apps. Install another operating system. Valve released the CAD files for the Steam Deck. Every dimension, every mounting point, every thermal pathway. And they'll almost certainly do the same here. The magnetic front plate pops off so you can literally snap on an E-Ink display. This is a gaming console designed by people who think the word locked is an engineering failure. Let's talk about what's actually running on this thing. SteamOS, Linux, Mesa, 26.1.dot, Proton, Experimental. Every layer of that software stack is open source, maintained by thousands of engineers across dozens of organizations. And Valve has been one of the largest commercial contributors to the Linux graphics ecosystem for over a decade now. They funded the Mesa Radeon drivers. They bankrolled Proton. They put full-time engineers on the Linux kernel. The Steam Deck didn't just prove Linux could game. It proved that sustained corporate investment in open infrastructure benefits everyone, including the company writing the checks. The hardware will age, every piece of silicon does, but when RDNA 4 drops into an AM5 socket or whatever comes next, the software stack Valve built doesn't care. It's not tied to one generation's firmware blob. Mesa gets a new backend. Proton keeps translating. And the open architecture means the community can push fixes upstream before Valve's own engineers get to the office. One commenter nailed it. They bought a high-end gaming rig, switched to Fedora as a daily driver, and it just works. That's the real product Valve is shipping. Not a box with last year's GPU, a proof of concept that open platforms win on the timeline that matters. The GameCube is cute. The ecosystem underneath it is genuinely beautiful engineering. So open platforms keep winning, but what happens when the protocol layer itself levels up? Let's talk about HTTP getting a new verb. In 1995, the HTTP 1.0 spec shipped with exactly three methods: get, head, post. That was the whole vocabulary. And for a protocol designed to serve physics papers between universities, three verbs was generous. 31 years later, we're still living with the consequences of that minimalism, because GET, the workhorse of the read-only web, has a design flaw that everyone just agreed to ignore. You can technically attach a body to a GET request. The spec doesn't forbid it. It just strongly suggests you shouldn't. And then every proxy, firewall, and browser implementation on Earth took that suggestion and ran with it in different directions. Some strip the body. Some reject the request. Some pass it through and shrug. This is the comedy of infrastructure. Billions of devices enforcing a gentleman's agreement that was never actually codified. And now nobody can change the behavior without breaking half the internet. RFC 10008 finally names the problem and gives it a proper solution. The QWERTY method. It does exactly what you think. It's GET, but with a request body. Safe, idempotent, cacheable. The kind of thing that should have existed in HTTP 1.1, but didn't because nobody anticipated that we'd need to send structured JSON filters just to ask a database what's in it. The practical win is real. Anyone who's built a search API knows the pain. You start with clean query parameters, then product wants nested filters, then someone needs array syntax, and now you're encoding JSON into URL strings, hitting character limits, watching sensitive parameters get logged by every middleware between the client and your server. The workaround has been POST, which works but lies. It tells every cache and proxy that you're mutating state when you just read it. Pull this thread and you find something lovely about how the web actually evolves. The IETF didn't break GET. They didn't try to retrofit body semantics onto 30 years of deployed infrastructure. They added a new verb. One comment pointed out that there are enterprise SSL intercepting proxies. Multi-thousand dollar appliances. That don't support anything beyond HTTP 1.1. Those boxes will choke on Kreedy, and that's fine. That's how open standards are supposed to work. The protocol moves forward. The equipment that can't keep up gets replaced. The spec is public, the implementation is up to you, and the ladder stays where everyone can reach it. The tools exist. They just took 3 decades to get the name right. So open protocols move the web forward. But what happens when the platforms built on top of it move trust backward? $410,000 in bets, 145 wagers placed over 5 months. 0 of them real. That number, zero, is the one worth sitting with. Not the flashy win screenshots, not the college students' carefully performed excitement, the zero. Because it tells you everything about the business model. There's a term in ecology called a brood parasite. The cuckoo lays its egg in another bird's nest. The host bird feeds the cuckoo chick, watches it grow. Doesn't realize it's raising something that will push its own offspring out. The cuckoo never builds a nest. It doesn't need to. It just needs to look enough like it belongs. Polymarket paid creators to post videos of bets that never happened. The creators weren't gamblers. They were cuckoo eggs. Placed in the feeds of young people who trust the creators they follow, designed to normalize the act of wagering real money on whether a president says the word McDonald. The host bird here is attention. The chick being pushed out is the viewer's money. One of the reader comments cuts right to the mechanism. Someone downloaded Kalshi, placed a real bet within 5 minutes. Blown away by how easy it was. That's the conversion funnel working exactly as designed. Fake content creates familiarity. Familiarity lowers the threshold. A 5-minute on-ramp to real financial exposure. Greased by fabricated social proof. Another commenter noted what the journal itself reported in an earlier piece. Unless you have serious data infrastructure, statistical modeling, and compute, you're going to lose. The house edge on prediction markets isn't hidden. It's just obscured by influencer videos showing a kid turning $100 into $100,000. The architecture here is worth naming. Polymarket's protocol is open. The contracts settle on chain. The order book is transparent. But the customer acquisition pipeline is closed, opaque, and built on manufactured trust. Open infrastructure does not automatically produce open outcomes. When the marketing layer is a black box of paid deception funneling retail money into a system structurally designed to take it, the openness of the settlement layer is irrelevant. The protocol is legible. The persuasion is not. And the 5-minute funnel only works because nobody reads the protocol. So what happens when someone actually builds tools that respect your intelligence? Let's talk about Plot 9. One commenter on Hacker News put it simply, after Plot 9 with a solid Python version of Purr and Dplyr, they might never reach for R again. That sentence carries more weight than it looks like on first read. To understand why, you have to go back to 2005 when Hadley Wickham started building ggplot2 for R, itself an implementation of Leland Wilkinson's 1999 book, The Grammar of Graphics. Wilkinson's insight was that charts aren't types. Bar chart, scatterplot, histogram. They're compositions. A chart is a mapping from data to visual properties, layered with geometric objects, scaled and coordinated. It's a language, not a menu. And for nearly 2 decades, if you wanted to speak that language fluently, you had to speak R. That was the deal. Python had mapped to Leblib, which is powerful the way assembly language is powerful. You can do anything, but you're going to feel every bite of it. And then Seebahn, which smoothed the edges, but still thought in chart types, not in grammars. Plot 9 changes the terms. The syntax is ggplot2. The operator overloading. And yes, the comments noticed the plus sign for layering plots. And yes, it is a choice. But it's the right choice because it mirrors exactly how ggplot2 works. The muscle memory transfers. The mental model transfers. The cheat sheets are so similar that one commenter mistook plot9s for ggplot2s. What matters here is what's happening underneath. This is an open source project, rebuilding one of the most beloved tools in data science, making it native to the ecosystem where most of the world's data work actually happens now. The grammar of graphics shouldn't belong to one language. It's a way of thinking about visualization, and locking it behind an R dependency meant that Python's massive community of data scientists and engineers had to either context switch between languages or settle for less expressive tools. The next release, 0.16, is already available as a pre-release. The project is active, the documentation is serious, and the community forming around it includes people migrating real workflows, not just kicking tires. Wilkinson wrote a book describing how graphics should work. Wickham built it for R. And now, 27 years later, that same grammar is becoming native Python. Open knowledge, re-implemented, made available where the practitioners are. The tools exist. The library is pip installable. If you've been waiting for Python to have a real grammar of graphics, it does. So Python gets a proper plotting library. But what happens when you can run a frontier-scale language model on your own hardware? What exactly is a moat made of when someone keeps draining the lake? GLM 4040 30 on a buoyant by Dizet Vider to the shake to like rare round abyss my teen pond cord moat for my panges axe dex squared. So, because it's a mixture of experts' architecture, meaning most of those parameters sit idle for any given query while the relevant experts fire. A million token context window. Performance benchmarks that put it shoulder to shoulder with Claude 4.8, Opus GPT 5.5, and Gemini 3.1 Pro. The frontier, as a category, now includes a model you can download. And that word, download, is where the real story lives. Unsloth got day zero access and built GGUFs, which means quantized versions that run on actual hardware people own. The 2-bit dynamic quant fits in 239 gigabytes. That's a single 256 gig unified memory MAC, one machine. On your desk, running a Frontier class model. The 4-bit quant, which Unsloth's analysis shows, is mostly lossless. Needs more room. Call it 400 gigs. But even that's two Mac Studios or a beefy workstation with a couple of 3090. One commenter is already getting 6 tokens per second on a Q4 quant with 512 gigs of RAM and 2 3090s. Crappy DDR4, they said. Faster memory would push it to 9 tokens a second. This is not theoretical. People are running it today. The quantization story deserves attention because it's counterintuitive. 2-bit quantization sounds brutal. You've crushed 84% of the model size, but the accuracy hit is only about 18% on top 1 prediction. And even that number is misleading. Unsloth breaks this down clearly. The difference isn't between correct and incorrect answers. It's between equally valid phrasings. The model doesn't forget that Paris is the capital of France. It might start its response with the instead of I. The semantic content survives compression remarkably well. The question nobody in the closed model business wants asked out loud, what are customers paying for when the open alternative matches your benchmarks and runs on hardware that costs less than a year of API fees? One commenter put it plainly. This shows the big labs have a head start, not a magic moat, and head starts by definition shrink. Z.A.A. released the weights. Unsloth built the quantizations. Llama.cpp runs the inference. Every link in that chain is open. Every piece is something the next builder can pick up. improve, redistribute the gap between what you can rent from a cloud API and what you can own on your own hardware just got measurably smaller, and it's only going to keep closing. We've been talking about big models getting smaller. Yo, brother, let's talk about a small model punching way above its weight. 3 billion parameters. To put that in perspective, the large frontier models people pay per token to access are rumored to run anywhere from hundreds of billions to over a trillion parameters. VibeThinker ships at 3 billion, and on reasoning benchmarks, outperforms Opus 4.5. The training technique is a combination called SFT plus GRPO. Supervised fine-tuning to teach the model how to think step-by-step, then group relative policy optimization to reward it for actually getting the right answer. Two stages, one tiny model. Benchmark topping results. Now let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because the obvious objection is real. These are Python-only benchmarks. Ask this model to write Rust or review a Go code base, and you're going to have a different conversation. One commenter compared it to teaching a child to drive. There's a floor of capability any model needs before specialization even matters. And that's fair. A 3 billion parameter model does not know everything. It is by design narrow. But here's why the narrowness is the point, not the limitation. The engineering elegance of VibeThinker is that it proves you don't need a data center scale model to reason well. You need the right training pipeline applied to the right domain. SFT gives structure. GRPO gives incentive. The model learns to chain logic rather than memorize patterns. At 3 billion parameters, that chain fits on a single consumer GPU. Someone in the comments is already running it on an RTX 3090 for source code security review, replacing a commercial API. Another points out, it could fit on a Talos edge chip. The same hardware already running 8 billion parameter Llama models. The craft here deserves real admiration. Getting a model this small to reason at frontier quality is not a brute force achievement. You cannot just scale down a large model and expect it to work. The researchers had to find the precise combination of training signals that teach reasoning as a skill rather than an emergent property of scale. That's genuinely beautiful engineering. It's the difference between building a bigger engine and building a more aerodynamic car. And the weights are on ArcSci. Open. Anyone can download them, quantize them, deploy them, improve them. A model that reasons at frontier quality, runs on hardware you can buy at Micro Center, and comes with no API bill, no rate limits, no terms of service that change on a Tuesday. The moat around reasoning capability just got a lot shallower, and 3 billion parameters is all it took to drain it. We talked earlier about infrastructure that just works, combined and few things embody that spirit quite like our next story. I once mass migrated a Redis cluster at 3 in the morning because someone on the product team had been quietly storing user session state in what we all assumed was a throwaway cache. 12 microservices deep, nobody had noticed. That memory is what makes this article hit so hard. Let's break down what a cache actually needs to do. First principles. A cache sits between your application and a slower data store. It holds hot data in memory. If the cache dies, the application should get slower, not broken. That's it. That is the entire contract. Memcacher honors that contract with an almost stubborn purity. No persistence to disk. No clustering protocol. No pub/sub. No scripting engine. No homepage trying to sell you an AI context engine. It stores keys and values in memory. And when you pull the plug, everything vanishes. That's not a limitation. That is a design decision, and it is the correct one. The engineering elegance here deserves real attention. Clustering happens entirely client-side. You hand your client library a list of memcached URLs. It hashes the key, picks a node. If a node dies, the client removes it from the hash ring, redistributes, and quietly tries to reconnect later. The server doesn't need to know about other servers. There is no consensus protocol, no split-brain scenario, no leader election at 2 a.m. Every operation is O1 by design. The authors chose that constraint deliberately because it means no single slow query can cascade into a system-wide stall. Compare that to Redis, which is genuinely excellent software that got caught in a familiar gravity well. It started as a cache, became a data structure server, became a message broker, became a database, and now apparently wants to be an AI context engine. Each feature is defensible in isolation. Together, they create a system where the operational assumptions are permanently ambiguous. Is this volatile or persistent? Is this a cache or a primary store? The answer depends on which team deployed it and whether they rid the docs. Memcached makes that ambiguity architecturally impossible. You cannot accidentally treat it as a database because it will forget everything the moment it restarts. The constraints are the feature. Simple tools that do exactly one thing. Transparently, with failure modes you can reason about in your head. That is how you build systems that survive contact with reality. And nobody embodied do one thing well quite like the original Vi Pause, a tool so focused it became the foundation for everything that followed. 160 kilobytes. The entire binary. On modern systems, that's smaller than most favicons. Smaller than the average Slack emoji. Bill Joy built one of the most feared, most revered, most accidentally memorized text editors in computing history, and it fits in less space than a medium resolution photo of your lunch. Be sorted around 1976 because Joy got tired of ED, which, if you've ever used ED, is the most relatable origin story in software. He built on ED's code base, which meant the resulting editor inherited something else from its lineage. A commercial Unix source code license that kept the actual source locked behind a paywall for over 20 years. 20 years! The editor that shipped on virtually every Unix system, that an entire generation of engineers learned through muscle memory and suffering, and nobody could legally read how it worked without cutting a check to AT&T's descendants. Then, in January 2002, Calder. In one of the few universally kind acts in the history of Unix licensing drama, released the ancient Unix code under a BSD-style license. Vi was finally free. Not Vim. Not NVI. Not Elvis. The original. The one your fingers already know. Run this forward. Imagine if every foundational tool had been locked away like this. Imagine if the source to grep required a license. If awk was proprietary, some of them were technically, and the reason we have GNU core utils at all is because people got tired of asking permission to understand the tools they used every day. Viz Liberation in 2002 was 20 years late, but it completed a circle. The tool that helped build Unix finally belongs to the people who use it. And the thing that gets me about that 160 kilobyte binary. No syntax highlighted, no multiple undo, no split screen. Is that it's still a complete, functional, genuinely powerful editor. Everything Vim added is wonderful. But the original proves something that matters. You can build tools that are small, opinionated, and permanent. The features we lack aren't missing. They were never promised. What it does in 160 kilobytes, and it will do it forever. And now anyone can see exactly how. Small, opinionated, and permanent. Three words that also describe one of computing's most unfairly maligned designs. The case against segmented memory is clean. Flat addressing is simpler. Developers hated it. The industry moved past it. Case closed. Except to follow that logic to its conclusion. If simplicity always wins, we'd still be on 16-bit flat addressing with 64 kilobytes of RAM. The 808 had elegant, simple, flat memory. And it hit a wall. The question was never whether to add complexity. It was which complexity to add. Intel's answer was genuinely clever. Two 16-bit values combining into a 20-bit address. Backwards compatible with 8080 code. And here's the part people forget. The architecture had 32 bits of address space baked into its semantics. Segment plus offset. That's enough for 4 gigabytes. In 1978, the chip only exposed 20 address pins, but the abstraction could have scaled for decades. The design assumed developers would treat segments as opaque handles. You'd ask the OS for memory, get a segment value back, index within it. The segment was a capability, not a number. If we'd respected that contract, each new chip could have widened the segment to physical mapping without breaking a single program. Instead, developers noticed segments were 16 bytes apart and started doing arithmetic on them, treating opaque handles as raw integers, smashing segment and offset together into flat 20-bit addresses. Every program that did this welded itself to the specific hardware mapping of one chip generation. Bill Sherlock, who wrote this article, lands on the right conclusion. The abstraction was sound, but it wasn't enforced. The hardware let you peek behind the curtain, and once you could, you would. There's a lesson here for anyone designing an interface. If your abstraction leaks, it isn't an abstraction, it's a suggestion, and developers don't follow suggestions. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for June 23rd, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet, 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth sharing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.